As most of you know, I found out a couple of months ago that I have type 2 diabetes, and it's going okay. It looks like it's going to be able to be managed diabetically, which is good. Dietly, not diabetically, but whatever. So that's got me thinking a lot about what I eat. And, you know, I wear it as a monitor sometimes, and I get instant feedback, and you can get addicted to that. Like, you know right away what's happening to your blood sugar. Shelby said, well, if I had that thing, I'd never want to give it up. I'd have to have one all the time. And they're not cheap, so, you know, I put it on for a while, and when the next one's supposed to go on, I don't put it on right away. But I'm learning how my body reacts to food, and I'm learning that, you know, you are what you eat. I knew that before. I was raised properly. My parents fed us very well, and they were health conscious, and I tended to get older and get busy and ignore all that, and I got to go back to it. So, yeah, you are what you eat. We've heard that, and, you know, it really has to do with the way we are physically. Could be like this, maybe. I don't know. But we're familiar with that, and it's a common expression. But there's another expression that's similar that, and this is just a lead-in, it's a similar one. And I'm not sure who said it first. This says Ben Carson said it. You are what you think. Some people say that Buddha said it first. I don't know. Obviously, Buddha's before Ben Carson. But I don't know. But you see these quotes. You are what you think. Brian Tracy, who's a, what do you want to call, motivational speaker, he says, you're not what you think you are, but what you think you are. It's a clever way of putting it. You know, we tend to be what's going on in our brain. Is his point there. Earl Nightingale, who was a motivational speaker, probably old enough to be Brian Tracy's father from a long time ago, he says, well, we become what we think about. So you have all these quotes, and I could have given you dozens more. But the point being that, and you know this from experience, but we don't always think about it, and that is what's going on in our brains has a lot to do with what we are and what we become and how we behave. And Jesus said the same thing in other words. He was talking to some Pharisees, and he said, you brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak what is good? For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. Or in the King James, it's, of course, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So Jesus is saying, you know, and heart doesn't mean, you know, the organ that Jeannie Gladden's having issues with. It means, in the Bible, it's talking about what makes you tick. Spiritually speaking, mentally speaking, you know, what's going on inside of you from a mental standpoint. And another way you can phrase that, I saw it, I thought this was nice. The mouth speaks what the heart is full of. That's what Jesus is saying. You know, it comes out eventually. It comes out. Try and teach this to the grandchildren as we read through Matthew. So here's a question for you today and for me, and that is, what is your heart full of? You know, what's going on inside? What's going on between your ears? What's your heart full of? Could be any number of things. Here's an interesting quote I found, too. The heart is a reservoir and the mouth of a faucet. When the faucet's turned on, whatever's in the reservoir comes out. So another way of saying that sometimes, and we all have experience with this, either ourselves or we have friends that are like this, is like whatever's inside comes out. You know, there's no filter. But Jesus says, you know, even in so many words, he's saying, even if you got a filter, sooner or later, it comes out. It comes out. So we really need to be concerned with what our heart is full of, to end this phrase with a preposition. You know, are we anxious on the inside? Are we worried about things? Do we have conflict going on, you know, constantly? We're challenging, or we feel like we're being challenged, we're challenging others. Is it fear? Is fear, which would go right hand in hand with anxiety. Is it tension? There's tension between people, or just inner tension with ourselves, or, you know, sometimes battling ourselves, worry. Is that what's going on in your heart? Is that what's going on in my heart? Well, sometimes it is. I'm sure it is with you too. Or is what we find in our heart peace? Is that the way it is? I can't speak for you, but, you know, when I started having to do research on diabetes, and which, by the way, most of you are closer to my age. I thought we called it diabetes. And I say that, and these younger people look at me, it's diabetes. I was like, well, it didn't used to be diabetes, did it? Anybody remember? Am I off? Anyway. You know, when I started doing research, one of the things, and it surprised me, I had no idea, is that stress is either a precursor, you could say, or it helps, you know, it helps you to have diabetes. It's one of the complicating factors that can lead to you having diabetes is stress. I live a very stressful life. I'm not at peace a lot. A lot of that's due to my schedule. A lot of it's due to the fact that I process things in my brain all the time. If there's a little bit of tension going on in my life, I run through it 15 different ways, and that's what's going on in my brain. So I've had to consider that as I, you know, think about my health. It's like, well, it's not just what I eat, it's also what's going on in between my ears. Excuse me. In Philippians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7, Paul wrote to the Philippians, he said, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." So there's a peace of God which he says, and I believe this. I know I've had friends that say this is a lot of, well, not that they don't believe the Bible, but that there's, they're not willing sometimes to accept the fact that God can just do something there, that there's a peace that you can't explain. I think that's exactly what it means. It surpasses all comprehension, that God can do something in your brain and in my brain and inside of us that we can't really explain. It's not necessarily logical. But it takes work on our part as well, and a yieldedness to him. So there's peace that God wants you to have and wants me to have. How does this work? Well, Paul gives us some more. You know, that's not all he had to say. He's got a lot in that whole chapter and in the whole book. But in the next two verses, he says, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is good repute, if there's any excellence and if there's anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. The things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you." So he's saying, it seems to me, that yes, God wants you to have peace inside, no matter what the outside circumstances are. And you do remember where Paul was when he wrote this. He was in jail. So he had made certain peace with that. And I think I'm going to read the verse where he explains that a little bit later. But God wants you to have peace, but it says there's a role that we have to play. It's like Paul's saying, what do you think about? What are you thinking about? What do you spend your time mulling over in your brain? I got to think about this. Now, when we went to visit one of our granddaughters who's in college, she's down at the University of Mississippi, and Shelby and I went down to Memphis, which is the closest sizable city, and we stayed there, and we went down to see her in Mississippi, not far from Memphis. And, excuse me, We went to a church service there, and it was very small. It might have been six of us, I don't know. It was a very, very small group. Felt sorry, that doesn't normally get much bigger than that. Some man from Arkansas came up and gave the sermon. He gave the sermon on Philippians 4, verse 8, and he gave it on all eight of those things. And I thought to myself, hey, there's eight sermons in there. I don't have to put them all in one sermon. So you're going to get sermon number one right now. That's the way, you know, I'm always looking for sermon ideas. And I heard that, and I thought, he's not covering this very deeply at all. He's just skimming the surface. I can take that and run with it. So that's what we're going to do. So today, I'm going to focus on whatever's true. That phrase, this is the New American Standard. I didn't mention that, but all of these quotes are from New American Standard today. And whatever's true. And that's a really broad word. And I wasn't real thrilled with the way that individual man covered it. Not that he covered it incorrectly, but I thought, you know, he just didn't have enough time really to develop it. I thought there probably a lot more there. So I've been thinking about that, reading about it, praying about it, working on it ever since then, last couple months. So if you like titles, some of you like titles, the title of this sermon series, really, is dwell on these things. Dwell, that's the way, think on these things, as King James in the New American Standard says, dwell. And that, I think, dwell is probably closer to what's intended there. Not that, Paul's saying, think about these things. It's not, think about it, and then think about something else. He's saying, let these things be the kinds of things that you think about all the time, that you meditate on, that are more, if you had to explain or characterize what's going on in your brain, it would be these things, all right, not just a momentary thought. So dwell on these things, and today it'll be whatever's true, and we'll look into that. First, what's the dictionary say about the word true? Of course, this word that's an English word. There's all kinds of different definitions. Could mean plumb. You know, in carpentry we use the word true for having to do with things being straight or plumb and so forth. But the two simple definitions that you get is in accordance with fact or reality. All right, that's the typical, it's true. Yeah, it's correct. It's a fact. All right. Another one is accurate or exact. In other words, not just that you have something that's not false, but you have it precise. Precision is a technical term, but you're not only is it right, but it's very close. It's fine-tuned, if you want to put it that way. Accurate or exact, something true. Is this all? Is this all we need to know? When Paul is saying, whatsoever things in the King James, whatsoever things are true, I want you to be thinking about those. Is he talking about things that just are factual? Think about things that are true as opposed to things that are lies. Is that what he means? Is he telling us to think about true things? Well, yes, but I think there's a lot more to it than that. As a physics nerd, I could say E equals MC squared is true. It's a fact. I sat in a class where we did a whole bunch of math equations that from something that we knew, I don't even remember what it was, and by messing with the math, you come up with this. Without doing any experimentation, just doing the math, you can go from something that we know, if I drop this, it's going to hit and bounce or whatever, and you get E equals MC squared. And that to me is a truth. We've proved that in a lot of ways. Now, does that mean that we should, is Paul saying, think of something that's true and then meditate on it. Meditate on E equals MC squared. Now, I could do that for a little while, and actually maybe I could be positive about that. I could say, it's wonderful the way the creation is, that mass and energy are kind of the different forms of the same thing, and that's amazing, and isn't God great? I could also think E equals MC squared is why we have atomic bombs, and that's a negative thing, right? So that's a fact, but that's not, do you think that's the kind of thing that Paul's saying? It's like, think about that. That's a fact. It's a fact. We can blow up vast areas of the earth with atomic weapons. So is it just the facts? Is that what we're supposed to do? Is just be concerned about the facts? Some of us are old enough to remember this one. And I guess it was sexist. It was always the man, right? Just the facts, man. When the woman would go off on a tangent about he was a good boy, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, just the facts. Is that what Paul's talking about? I don't want you to be focused on negative things, on things that are not true, lies. I want you to be focused on facts. Well, that was part of his job. Friday's job was to focus on the facts. Is that what Paul's talking about? I don't think so. But we'll move on from there. Whatever's true, all right? So you're going to look at the news to find out what's true. Now, some of us would argue that you don't always get the truth on the news. News is a lot different now because they got to fill up 24 hours worth of news, and there isn't 24 hours worth of news, at least that people want to listen to. So they just rehash the same thing and give you all kinds of opinions. So is that what we're talking about? Is that we're talking about that kind of news, or even the kind of news that I grew up on with these guys? You remember, some of you remember these guys. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. And that's the way it is. Hopefully it was the way it was, except the government sometimes lied to us, and so he's just reporting what they said. And Howard K. Smith, we never watched Howard K. Smith at our house. I don't know why. Maybe that was the lowest network. I don't know. We always knew the way it was because that's what was on when I was growing up. But every once in a while, I'd see the Good Night, Chet, Good Night, David. One of them in New York, one of them in Washington, right? And, you only had a half hour then, so you didn't get told too much. There wasn't too much time for opinions. Now we have all day long for opinions. Is that what Paul's talking about? Get the facts. watch the news, make sure you get the news, get the paper, get whatever, and understand all you can, not understand, I shouldn't use that word, just find out all you can find out about things going on in the world, and that's what you should be thinking about. And that's how God's going to help you to bring peace to your life. Well, that's more like the facts, just like get the facts. I don't think so. I heard, by the way, you can take this or leave it, but I heard a sermon some years back from a guy, I think he was from Philadelphia, and I didn't know him, but he said that, you know, our preoccupation with watching world events is not what God meant when he's, you know, what the Bible means when you're supposed to watch things. It wasn't trying to watch the news and figure out what's going on. That was his opinion. I agree with it, by the way. So, is this what he's talking about? Well, is it talking about what other facts? I mean, maybe you said this yourself, but you certainly know somebody who did, so they say, I'm just telling you how I feel. All right? And maybe it's something really negative that you really don't want to hear, or I don't want to hear because it's about me, but somebody's telling me about myself, and say, what? It's how I feel, and it's honestly how I feel. So the justification is, well, it's true, therefore it's worth saying and thinking. You need to think about it. Well, I would say no. I don't think that's what Paul's thinking about, that we can have negative thoughts, but because they're true, because it's how we feel, you know, we scuffed our knee and we don't feel very well about that, that we can then act on that. Is he talking about feelings? Is he talking about opinions? I don't think he's talking about any of those things. Not hurts, not feelings, not even the news, the facts, just the facts that Joe Friday would get. So what kind of things do I think he's talking about? Well, I think we need to take a closer look. It would help if we took a closer look to the word that he used. He was writing in Greek, or most likely, and that's the language that they, you know, they understood in the diaspora where he was writing these letters. And if we look it up, the word true or truth, you know, one would be the adjective. The adjective is aletheis. Aletheis. If you can speak Greek, I can't speak Greek. That would be true or truthful. It would be describing something that is true or something that is truthful. The Greek word for truth that's used, it's the same word, only the noun form, is aletheia, okay. That would be true. So we have things that are true, the adjective or an adverb, truthful, you say something in a truthful way, and you have the noun, which is truth. And that's the word that he used. And so what does that mean? Well, the idea of that word, not that this proves what we need to believe that it means, but just to give you some background, that word comes from, you have the A in the front, that means without or without. So it's talking about not being hidden. Not being hidden, that's what the truth is. That's why I like this little picture here. That we have to peel something back because it would be hidden otherwise. Now, again, that doesn't prove anything. A word derivation doesn't prove what it means, but in reality, that is how it's used. And I think it's okay in this case to look at that and say, yeah, that gives us some insight into the word. It's something that would be covered up normally, but you uncover it, and that's the truth, and those are things that are true. That would be the way the Greeks used it. In according to the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, the judicial use of this word, all right, truth would be the actual state of affairs, as opposed to, well, this guy says this and this guy says that, and the truth would be whatever the truth is. Might not be what he says, might be what he says, or vice versa, or something in between. So that's a judicial word, and that's more of the Joe Friday get the facts. Okay, so that's one of the acceptable meanings of that word and how it was used in Greek culture at the time the New Testament was written. Another way it was used was in a philosophical sense, though. You got a picture of Socrates here, supposed to be the philosopher, right? And it means real in an absolute sense. In other words, things that are real, real true at their root, at their core, they're true. And it's not necessarily always what you see. In other words, you could see something or you think you see something, but the truth is deeper. The fact the truth's hidden a little bit, you've got to peel something back to see it. And that's what science does. Science tries to peel back layers of of whatever to see where, you know, what's going on at a more basic level. So that's a philosophical use of that word back in the same time as the New Testament was being written. And when you combine these meanings, and this kind of the way that it's used in contemporary Greek at the time, it gets the meaning of being genuine or proper. In other words, real, genuine, okay? Or proper in the sense of being acceptable or good, you know, having a it's good because of it is just good at its core, not just looks good. So that's the way this word was used at the time that Paul used it. And when we look in the Bible, it's in the New Testament. The forms of this are in the New Testament probably 150 times or so. I didn't count them all. But there's quite a few. And many times, it's just referring the way we would use the word truth. Just the truth of the matter. All right? That igloo cooler over there is orange, I guess. It's orange, right? That's just it's a true or false statement. The other, the crock pot is red and black, you know. That's a matter, it's either true or it's not true, okay? Obviously, that's a simple use of that word, and it's used that way in the Bible many, many times. Is that what Paul had in mind in Philippians 4, verse 8? I don't think so. He's not saying, look, I want you to look at something and determine, well, you know, what color it is and whether, you know, you think it's this or that. That's just, in a sense, a trivial or a normal everyday use of that word, and I don't think that's what he was using it for. And that it's not going to bring you any peace to know that know something in detail about a specific thing, whether that's true or whether that's false. It's not going to bring you peace. But there's other New Testament uses of this word. One of them is a quality or a character of someone or something, that something is true. Okay, and it's used that way quite a bit. We'll go into that. And you could say moral excellence. That's what some of the Greek dictionaries will say. That someone that has a certain character trait, you know, that are excellent, they are moral, they are upright, they are righteous, all right? That's a use of this word, true. And we wouldn't normally do that in English now. We don't say, well, he's true, you know. We sometimes say something like, he's the real deal, or we say something along that line, but we don't use true as that adjective, but they did in Greek. True also, and truth has to do with a way of life, as opposed to the understanding of a typical world citizen. That there is a way that the Bible refers to as the truth, and that's not the way that the typical citizen of whatever society you're in thinks and acts and behaves. So that's another way that word is used. And a third way, and these aren't the only ones, but these are the main ones that I was able to find, is an understanding of what God's doing in the world. That's the truth. And Paul uses that kind of terminology to show, you know, we understand this, and that's the truth, and other people don't understand it because God hasn't opened their mind to it. And so there's a difference between what the Christian understands and what the non-Christian understands. And that's, you know, Paul refers to that a lot in his writings as well. So let's look at these one at a time. If we look at them and just, you know, get a feel for how the Bible uses these words, and when we think about whatsoever is true, if that's what you're going to go home and think about, well, what kinds of things should they be? What kinds of things? So we're not talking about facts, we're not talking about opinions, we're not talking about feelings, we're talking about other attributes here. And one of them, as he said, is the character or moral excellence. Jesus talks about the Father in John 8. By the way, the words for true and truthful and all, their truth is in there over 100 times. But to the adjective, true, is only in there about 26 times, and you know, two-thirds of them are in the book of John. So John liked to use that term. And John is kind of a philosophical book in a lot of ways. It's written at a different level, in a different way than the other three Gospels. John 8:26, I have many things to speak and to judge concerning you, but he who sent me is true. Jesus saying, he who sent me, the Father, he's true. Well, that's not, you know, he's a fact and not fiction. You know, no, I mean, he's true. It has to do with his character. He's genuine. He's genuine. He's morally excellent. He's, you know, he's all of those things and more. When he who sent me is true, and the things which I heard from him, there's those I speak to the world. Jesus talked about himself in John 7. He says, he who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true. And there's no unrighteousness in him. He's talking about himself. He seeks the glory of his Father, and so he's true. He's a reflection of the Father. Of course, he tells us elsewhere that, you know, you've seen me, so you've seen the Father. He showed us on earth what the Father is like. So that's true. That's talking about being true, not talking about a fact necessarily or a particular thing you can say, yeah, this is true. It's not talking about this being true. It's talking about a person or a being being true. All right. It's being morally excellent, having a character that's beyond reproach. That's true. Also in John chapter 1, said, we read that the Word became flesh. Here's John, right, talking about Jesus. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. You know, Jesus was full of truth. This is a description of how he was. Not just that he was always right. That wasn't his point. The point was that he was a reflection of the Father, which all, you know, is representative of all truth. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15, Paul says, I write so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God. This is an interesting verse here. Which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support, or King James says, ground of the truth. So the church is supposed to be, that's us, right? The church is supposed to be a pillar and ground or support of the truth. It's supposed to, we should be a reflection of what God is. And unfortunately, we, not just us as individuals, but us as a collection, being Christians all over the world, we fall way short of this many, many times. But Paul's saying, you know, we're supposed to be a support. We're supposed to be an example and a witness to the world of what God's way is like. And, you know, we fall short of that way too much. So this word true, or especially this in the adjective form, this has to do with the characters that somebody has, their moral excellence, their standing, their righteousness, the way they come across, and the way they reflect God in their lives, or if it is God, you know, he reflects himself, I guess. So that's one use of this word, and that's, I would suggest, is one of the ways that when we're thinking about whatsoever is true, then we think about this. Think about positive, godly examples, that those are the kind of things that we should be thinking about. And you're not going to find too many of them on the news, quote unquote. There aren't too many godly examples in the world. I'm not saying there aren't any. There are some. And there's people that do a good thing. But you don't. That doesn't get viewership, and it doesn't sell advertising. It's the negative stuff, and that's what we hear and read all the time. So here's one area. How about truth as a way of life? The Bible has a lot of that. The New Testament especially has a lot of that. That it's a way of life. It's a way of being. It's a way of living. And I would say it's a way of showing what the kingdom is like. Because we, you know, the judgment is on us now. So we get to live a certain way as an example to non-Christians as to what it would be like if everybody was Christian. But, you know, if everybody was like Brian, everybody's like Brad, everybody's like Phil, you know, then the world would be different. All right? That's part of our job, is to model that for non-Christians, for non-believers. So let's look at a couple verses here, more than a couple. Says they question him, saying, Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly, and that you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. The way. So they use that term way, and you see that a lot in the New Testament too. That the truth is it has to do with a way of life. It's a way of behaving. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of interacting with others. It really, there's, you know, whole sermons in there of how we are to live and how we are to behave. Those are manifestations of the truth, this way of life. John 4:24, we know this one, it's a memory scripture. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Spirit and truth. All right, so the spirit having to do with its relationship with God, but truth being that there's that relationship has certain expectations. And that means we walk this way, not this way. Okay, we can't be, you know, we can't be double-minded in that. We have to walk in the way that God wants us to walk. And that's the way, that's referred to as truth, or the truth, in the New Testament. Paul writes to the Galatians, and he's upset that they have discarded some of the things that he taught them. And he says, "You're right, you were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth?" So the truth is something you can obey or not obey. You know, it's a way that you can walk or not walk, okay? And of course, it's a broad word there, truth. He doesn't explain, you know, in the rest of the book, he explains specifically what he's talking about. But the principle applies to all across the board, that God shows us a way to go, and that's the truth, and we are to walk in that direction, but we have to make a choice. Because, you see, like in 2 Timothy here, chapter 2 and verse 16, "But avoid worldly and empty chatter," all right? I didn't think of this before, but I'm thinking about cable news. I'm not a big fan of cable news, okay? But a lot of it is worldly and empty chatter, because I got to fill 24 hours worth of, you know, saying the same thing over and over again. "Why? For it will lead to further ungodliness, and their talk will spread like gangrene among them," and he mentions a couple of people by name, "men who have gone astray from the truth." So the truth is something you can leave, and we understand that. We understand that. We can turn our back on the truth and walk in a different direction. It's a way of life that we can choose or not choose. So these men have, at least at this time that this was written, they've chosen to walk away. And teaching that the resurrection has already taken place and upset the faith of some. Here's another verse, which in James, somebody can leave. And of course, here's the encouragement to help somebody who's in, might be in the process of leaving. "My brethren, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins." So it's possible to, again, turn away from the truth. And we understand that. There's a way of life that, and that's part of what Paul's saying. Think about this way of life. Think about this direction that God has pointed us in. Think about those things. And you know, have our minds there, and then they're not on the negative thing, and God will bring peace. Now, one more. And I could have done more, I suppose, but these are three. Truth has to do with what God is doing. What he's doing. You could say, well, that's kind of similar to the way, but it's a little bit different, because God's doing things, and it's not apparent to non-Christians what he's doing. They don't get it at all. God hasn't opened their minds to that. He says, if you continue in John 8, verse 31, 32, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." That was the motto of the university that I went to. It was right on the, you walked right across the seal in one of the buildings, and that's what it said, "The truth will make you free." And there's truth there. It is. You know, truth is very liberating, and it's a good thing. And we are blessed to have God specially call us as Christians and call us out of a different way of thinking and to begin to learn to think the way he thinks. And it's a big difference. And by doing that, we accept what we read in the Bible, and we have now an idea of what God is doing. And you see over and over, especially with Paul, he talks about a mystery. A lot of times he talks about a mystery. He's not always talking about the same mystery. Sometimes he talks about the mystery of Gentiles coming to Christ without becoming Jewish converts, and that's a mystery. Sometimes he talks about the mystery of just with God, just, you know, salvation itself through Jesus' death. That's a mystery that they couldn't have predicted, that people would never have guessed that part of the plan was the Messiah had to die for people's sins. You know, it was a mystery. So he talks about these different mysteries. And they're mysteries because God didn't choose to reveal them to people before Jesus' resurrection. And when they were revealed, they were revealed to people that were in the body. They were, you know, people in whom the Spirit dwelled, and where God had revealed what he's doing. It wouldn't be available, as Paul Simon says, you know, the information not available to the common man. God doesn't just dole out that. It's the yieldedness to his way that gives us the opportunity to be given an understanding, because we accept it. We accept what God says. We just don't reject it as out of hand. It's not that we're so smart. It's that we're open to God telling us what he's doing and believing what he says. In John 16, it talks about the Spirit, and New American Standard translates it as a person with its pronouns. But it says, when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you, or it will guide you into the truth, where he will not speak on his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak. He will disclose to you what is to come. So he will guide us. You know, the Holy Spirit guides us into truth, guides us into understand what it is that God's doing. And that's been a mystery, and it's a big miracle. It's a miracle, a huge miracle. And Paul talks about it that way. And he phrases it like, we understand it because God has opened our minds to it. Not because we're so smart or we got some special insight into the scriptures or anything like that. It's because God opens the minds of Christians to understand. And of course, the prayer there in John 17. Sanctify them in the truth, for your word is truth. So the whole Bible, you know, that's the truth that we understand. And it's way different than what we're going to hear on the radio or see on TV or just hear around us. I think that's what Paul's getting at. Paul's saying, you know, there's some things that God has shown us, and they're true, and they're about him, they're about what he's doing, they're about his church, his plan, all of these things. They're very important. Think about those things. Dwell, not just think about them, but dwell on these things. Have them in your mind. And that's one step out of eight that he gives there of how God will bring peace to us, not the tension that sometimes in our lives, but to bring peace, because we have an understanding of the overall plan, and it's all going to be okay in the end, no matter what's happening now. And not only that, we're going to be on the right side of things in the end, and that's comforting to know. Just to know, we don't have to know all the details. Sometimes we think we do. We work out all the charts. We got all these details, and thinking, nah, just knowing that we're on the right side should be just plenty right there. That, you know, we're on God's side, and he wins. He is winning, and that's all we need. That's really all we need to worry about. We don't need to worry about it. That's all we need to know. We need to know. The battle's already been won, and the war's already been won. There's going to be a few more battles, but the war's already been decided, and we're on the winning side. And that should bring us peace. So back to Philippians 4, verse 8. You know, finally, brethren, whatever true, whatever is honorable, right, pure, lovely, whatever is good repute, if any excellence, anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. The things which you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. So there's more to it than just, I mean, thinking about them is a big deal. And that's what God expects us to do. He expects us to fill our minds with all of these things. And if we do, we'll have peace. But there's more to it. It doesn't say just think about things. It's also, Paul said, the things that you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, in other words, is his example, practice these things. Oh, there's action involved too. There's action. It's not just sit in our easy chair and think. And that's a good thing to do. Think as we go to bed, as we wake up, whatever, think about these things, but also practice these things. We have to do some things. So, as we wrap up the sermon, what's on the to-do list? What are we supposed to do? Action items. We have action items. It says, practice these things. So it's not just thinking some things, it's doing some things too. So what are we supposed to do? Well, got a couple examples here. Biblical truth is not mere facts, and especially not opinions or feelings, the kind of things I talked about at the beginning. So it's not what people around us typically would say, that in order to be informed, we have to know this, that, and the other thing. Well, the Bible says to be informed, we need to know some other things. And we need to have less of these things, these opinions, feelings, mere facts, so you know what's going on. Less of that, so there's room for the things of God. Because the more you fill your mind, and this is no secret, we all know this from experience, you fill your mind with all the bad stuff that's going on in the world, And you worry about it. You worry about when it's going to come to your neighborhood, or when this is going to happen, or when that's going to happen. Or, you know, I can remember, you know, trying to figure out the prophetic timelines and adding up all these numbers and making little charts and all that, trying to figure that kind of stuff out. And maybe you've done that. Maybe you like doing that. But you know what? You spend time doing that, and you don't have time really to think about what God is doing, the big picture items that he wants us to have focus our minds on. The brain's only so big. I had a boss one time, and he was only a couple years older than me, but I was pretty young when I worked for him. But he would make the comment, and I believe there's some truth to it. He's saying sometimes it was hard to learn new things because there wasn't any room. He got to the point where he filled his brain, and if he had to learn something new, he had to get rid of something in order to make room. And I thought that was funny when I was in my 20s, and now it's like I'm there. You know, that's. In fact, I've been there for a while. I can't remember a lot of things. But I do notice, and this is so true, this is just came into my head here. I spent, and you know, you're familiar, I was 3 months in Thailand teaching some Burmese and some Thais, and my job was to teach church doctrines, but you know, obviously I'm teaching the Bible the way I understand it. And I'm putting classes together every day, I'm teaching classes every day, several classes, and I'm doing this all the time. Every day. And what little bit I had to run my business, I had really good people back then. I didn't have to hold their hands, so I could run my business from half a world away in 12 hours difference. And all I had to do was make sure their paychecks, you know, were there on time and they were happy. And they just took care of my work. And it was really nice. But what I noticed, I don't know if it would be true now, you know, older, don't have quite the brain power that I had then, but all day, either teaching or reading the Bible or preparing messages, scriptures, like I could say, this one's here, here's here. It could be a question in class, and I knew where to go because it was on my mind all the time. And I guess that's the beauty of being, you have, you know, sometimes we can argue about whether having full-time ministry is important or not, but you know what, if you are full-time and you don't have another, you don't have to earn your living in another way, you have more time to spend in the Word, and things are more accessible. They're not buried deep because you got to worry about your work. And not being worried about work is a bad thing. We all have to be worried about work. But there is an advantage to not having to be worried about that too much, because we only have so much brain power. You know, where are we going to use it? And a lot of times, speaking for myself, I've wasted it being going down this rabbit hole or that rabbit hole. And you got to have a finite amount of capability there. So it matters what I choose to do with it. And that's the point of this whole message, or even series of messages, is that Paul says, all right, you've got so much to go with. Here's what I want you to spend it on. And if you do, it will bring you God's peace. So try to minimize, or you know, lessen the amount of all this noise that's around us, that's on our phones, it's on our television, it's just everywhere. It's on the billboard. It's just, you can't get away from it. But try to minimize that so that we have, you got room in there to think about things that are true, for number one on the list there. So just because it is true, technically, from, you know, it's true as opposed to it's not a lie. That's not sufficient reason to dwell on it. There's a lot of bad news. It's just no point. What's the point of dwelling on that? So biblical truth is not facts, it's not opinions, it's not feelings. It has to do with, as well, the areas that we talked about, it has to do with the character of God and what he's doing and the way of life that he teaches us. What else on a to-do list? Here's the second thing. Biblical truth is truth in the sense that it's hidden from those not following God. Okay, that goes back to that little picture. It's hidden. And so that I think that the derivation of that word, the etymology, is interesting, and has truth in it, if I can use that word. We have to follow God's lead. God, he provides a direction for us. We choose whether to follow it, or how, and to what degree we follow it. So the more we follow it, as I was saying when I was in Thailand, the more my mind was on the Bible and on what God was teaching us, the better recall I had of it. it's just a fact of life. I would imagine your brain works in a similar way. It's going to have better access. Maybe you have better access all the time than I do, but you'll have better access to what's important if we spend less time worrying about the things that we can't change anyway. Being true in the Bible is a matter of character and moral excellence. Okay, that's what it's talking about. It's something that is a characteristic of God, characteristic of Jesus, and we're supposed to be developing that same type of character. God has set the standards. Jesus fulfilled those standards, okay, perfectly. And we're called to walk in Jesus' steps. All right? We're not going to be perfect. We're not him, but we're to walk in that direction. All right, we're to walk in that direction. Be like him. The church, that means us collectively, the church is expected to model these standards to unbelievers. So, you know, how are we doing, as I mentioned? How are we doing there? And I, you know, speaking for myself, not, you know, I'm just one part of the church, but I've at times just gotten all worked up about things I didn't really need to be worked up about. And so we tend to be that way as human beings, and God's calling us to peace, all right? It's a different approach to things. And biblical truth is a way of life. All right, and we know that. You know, I'm just rehashing here what I already went through. To follow this way is to stand in opposition to what's going on around us. The world's systems, the world's methods, the world's immorality. We take a stand against that. Now, that doesn't mean we have to hold a sign and stand on the corner and all that. I guess if you want to do that, that's not necessarily wrong. But we take a stand just by our own behavior. And how we and what we say, what we think, we are a representative, a citizen of the kingdom, right? We're an ambassador of the kingdom, and people notice that. People notice that, and what fruit it's going to bear when—that's up to God. The truth can be obeyed or walked away from, as we went through. So we want to continue walking in the way we're supposed to. And finally, biblical truth reveals what God is doing. All right, so it's good for us to focus on the plan, the big picture, not the minute details where sometimes we speculate, it could be this way, it could be that way, and then we can lose sleep over just the exact nature of it when the Bible's not abundantly clear on that particular issue. But the big picture is very clear, and that's what we need to focus on. And not the world's current reality. Because what the world, what human beings think is reality really isn't reality. You know, reality is a spiritual thing. The earth, in my opinion, is temporary along with the rest of the universe. It's not permanent. It's permanent as far as us we're concerned. It's a lot older than us. It's going to be around longer than us and so forth. But it's not what's real. It's what God created. And his existence is what's real. And we're going to be able to be there. And that's just an amazing thing to think about. That's something we can meditate on and dwell on. That what we see is temporary. It's something God made for a temporary usage, you know, so that he could create a family. We sing that in one of the songs in the book. He made all this so he could make a family. But the reality is his world. If I can use that term, his existence. And he's inviting us to that, which is amazing. And it's God's truth that makes us free, at peace. Okay, we can be at peace. So, yes, I think it's true, as I'm finding out with my diabetes, that you are what you eat, but it's also true that we are what we think. And that's what really counts. That's what's really going on inside of us. So, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? And is it true? Is it true? Paul said, these things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, these things that you've watched my behavior, my life, just like we can read about him, we can read about Jesus. Practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you.